I hope you rested well. We've got a, I think we have some wonderful speakers today. I'll try to set the tone in a few remarks I've prepared for you myself. I have to refer you back to our October issue, in which the headline read, "But no one laid it out in spades." I had reference to the Farmers and Ranchers Congress held under the money banner and auspices of Willie Nelson in St. Louis shortly before the election. It was an array of politicians with the wisdom of what? If I were stating it in terms of science, I'd say Stone Age. We were told by Hightower, Secretary of Agriculture, how the rascals were cheating the farmers. We were told by Senator Harkin how he was going to roll up his sleeve and fight. You know, on election day, I had occasion to drive approximately from Kansas City to the Oklahoma line. And in the process, I heard a number of people on the radio being interviewed, but mostly commercials for candidates running for something from county commissioner on up. I tell you, you farmers are the most lucky people in the world. You've got fighters out there by the hundreds. They are your friends. And they will roll up their sleeves and go to work. And I sometimes wonder why you're in the position you're in with all these heady fighters and these courageous people. I think most of them are probably even sincere. The problem is what they don't know, they just simply don't know. And so I ask a question this morning: how has this process been contrived of stripping threadbare an entire population that at one time owned at least 40 acres of virgin land? The quote you will recognize is from Ferdinand Lundberg in The Rich and the Super Rich. And over the past 6 months, we've attempted to answer that question in Acres USA, specifically in the last word column. And what I have tried to relate to you is how a gigantic trust came into being in 1913, how science was fenced in to serve that master, its sustenance being drawn chiefly from the government and from foundations created for the purpose of serving the merchant. No less than 6 last word entries, almost all of them dealing with the legal process, with this business of claiming for the government legitimacy, which every government seems to claim. And I think we've informed you how your rights have been done away with, not by force of arms, but by the cleverness of lawyers and legal sleight of hand. I'm not going to recite anew what we've said in these columns. You have it. But we're going to start talking about a new thing that's an extension of the legal revolution, the one that has taken the Constitution and sequestered it from the American life while putting you entirely under a contract arrangement with your government. Christopher Hollis was in the United States from England back in the 30s. He was a professor at Notre Dame, and he wrote a book called The Breakdown of Money. And what Christopher Hollis pointed out, that the judgment was made in the wake of the establishment of the Federal Reserve System to break down the buying power of the American dollar so those indifferent American industrialists would have to hunt the world over for new markets to consume their production, because the American people were no longer able to consume their own production. This world was best accomplished. This world that they envisioned best accomplished and accommodated the wishes of the international traders and that gigantic trust that Lindbergh, Congressman Lindbergh, spoke about. the Federal Reserve. Only in a dire emergency have these managers of public policy departed from this grand plan. In World War I, Herbert Hoover was appointed economic czar. And the first thing he did was to raise the price of wheat to parity and a little above. Because that way, and only that way, with the storable commodities that accounted for the production off of 80% of the harvested acres, could the income be generated on an earned basis to fight the war. That act was repeated when World War II broke out. Within months after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, the United States got a stabilization measure. And that stabilization measure had attached to it a Stigall Amendment that accounted for parity for the storable commodities and also for the semi-storable commodities. It was a stabilization measure for the American economy and not for the farmer. But you see, that 1913 game plan was only on the back burner. It was not off the stove at all. Early in the 30s, because the Constitution said that treaties had to be ratified by the Senate, a new nomenclature was invented: reciprocal trade agreements. These agreements were structured and titled so they could be executed without that unhandy reference to the Senate for ratification. It was part of this earlier game plan, the one that accommodated that gigantic trust that had been created. I think some parts of this story you've been told before. I'll sketch it very briefly. We did have that stabilization during World War II. We did not have it during the Korean War or during the Vietnam War. But in 1948, this stabilization for practical effects was terminated. We invented at that time something that we're using right now, and I'll cover it with you a little later. They called it the Brannon Plan in those days. There would have to be structured some sort of a subsidy arrangement to keep the American farmer from going broke too fast while we put our production into international trade channels at world prices. That was the Farm Bill of 1948. It was signed by Harry Truman. It extended the full power arrangement for a year or two, and then it went into effect. It was delayed until Eisenhower finally took office. But something happened during that period of time. When the British saw that we were no longer going to maintain a structural balance for the American economy, they devalued the British pound. And with that went all the sterling bloc nations. This made the United States the high market of the world. And in the next 5 years, we imported so much material, like kinds, wheat, corn, and so on, over what we exported, we piled up a $6 billion surplus. A very big amount in those days. A very big amount. But this wasn't our opener at the importing game. We imported more farm goods than we exported during each of the Depression years. Translated into a single crop, into wheat, it accounted for 10 crops a week being imported into the United States during the 30s. We imported more than we exported each of the war years. We didn't feed the world, but because we had this structural balance, some of our people weren't living on beans 6 nights a week. They had a steak now and then. And the red meat industry bounced back, and so did dairy. And so did all the storable commodities back to the 1929 level. And they did it within a matter of months after the stabilization went into effect. We imported more than we exported between 1946 and 1950, and 52. And then we went into our sliding parity, where we determined we were going to use the Brannan expression. In order to accommodate this change in farm politics, farm pricing, we introduced into the system a technology that should have been ruled from the scene by reasonable people. I take the position that it's 30 years overdue. It's 30 years overdue that we should have gotten rid or had a public policy to phase out the chemicals of organic synthesis. There's some of it happening now, not because of public policy, but because farmers are coming to their senses in the usual way, one at a time. There are some missed lessons in this. In this process I've described in a very faint sketch, we have introduced a concept to the American people, and most of all to the American farmer. There isn't one in a thousand that doesn't believe it as an article of faith. And that concept is that we produce so much we couldn't use it if we stayed up all night eating. You believe it? Why, they've got granaries running down the street, and every fall somebody piles soybeans on the main street of a small town. But the fact is, we're not even self-sufficient. Do you think that Jimmy Carter embargoed our crops because of Afghanistan? He embargoed them because we were getting dangerously low in our inventories. We are importing 15% of all the red meat in international trade channels. Translate that into feed grain consumption. Is it any wonder we've got granaries and bins full of corn and feed grains? I think we need to rethink the equation. In a couple of our recent issues, we've carried an expression of this using government statistics on pork and beef. I think we've proved beyond a shadow of a doubt the validity of what I'm telling you. Ladies and gentlemen, it is not that surpluses bring on faltering parity for farming. It's quite the opposite. Faltering parity brings on surpluses because we do not generate the income that enables us to consume the production our resources and labor have accounted for. It's Christopher Hollis all over again. Way back when Henry Ford was the prime industrialist of the United States, he said, the American labor force has to have 50 cents an hour, because if it doesn't earn 50 cents an hour, it cannot buy a Model T Ford. He took the lead and raised the wage level to 50 cents an hour in the automobile industry, and others followed suit. But our newspaper pundits complain about subsidies. Our Kansas City Star guru last Sunday declared that trade deficits were really a good thing. Now, this is economic illiteracy speaking. It's worse than that. It's madness. I'm going to leave it to our good friend R.E. McMaster to expand on that. I think he could probably do a better job, because I know this klutz. Not McMaster, the one on the Kansas City Star. There is a troublesome reality of our time. We have these professors, we have these government experts who with a straight face talk about trading partners. Since when is the guy you're trading or in competition with your partner? But this is all the nomenclature we're being used. I had a thing hit my office some months ago from Sri Lanka. Bring your industry to Sri Lanka. We have, and it gave the figure, how many thousand well-trained workforce at a monthly wage of $35 an hour, a month, which computes to about 8-9 cents an hour. That's real efficiency, ladies and gentlemen. I wish all these people working for me would just come in and work for free. God, would we get efficient. I suspect that many of these pundits come about these conclusions that there is some real basis for trade between a 10-cent an hour country and a $10 an hour country, because when they go to Egypt, they stay at the Hilton Ramses. The service is better than the service here. The prices are American prices, not Egyptian prices. And when they go to Rio de Janeiro, they see Sugarloaf in the distance, and the hotel they stay in is nonpareil. The service is excellent. The food is good. That poverty in those favelas on the hill is an abstraction, just as the poverty here is an abstraction. They go in their little academic seminars and they talk about trading partners and free international trade and cycles and all that thing. And they don't pause to realize there is no basis for this. There's all the difference in the world between these countries, the conditions under which they labor. Well, if this were our game, what business do we have having Social Security or workman's compensation or unemployment insurance or health care or retirement programs? If we're going to compete with the world that way, then let's start getting on some dirt floors, because that's where your labor is going to live. Some part of it is happening, however. You read in the paper, General Motors is closing X number of plants. All your high-salaried employees are being retired early. I compute by 1992, possibly 80% of the labor force in the United States will have entered labor channels at the $4 and $5 an hour range. We're in the business of reducing everybody to the $4 and $5 an hour range. And it's hard to maintain an American standard of living at that wage rate. It isn't even worth it for your farm wife to leave the farm to go to work for $4 and $5 an hour. She can do more for herself running anything, any kind of cottage approach from the farm, than she can get in the labor market today. It's this service to this unreality that we have programs, that we tax ourselves goofy, that we'll accept any cockamamie scheme any screwball can come up with, as long as we can leave our farm prices down here at that world level. Let's look at our programs. As you know, in our basic storable commodities, we have this market price. This is the price for trade channels internationally. Then we have our government experts who set target prices. These are never land prices up here somehow. They don't want to use the word parity, so we come up with target prices. And then we have the loan price. So let's take something like corn in County X anywhere. It'll vary from county to county. The market price may be $1.90. Putting a loan price at $2.50 on a bushel of corn. The target is up here in the Neverland of $3.07. $1.17 spread. As I said, this will vary from county to county depending on where you are from the terminal markets. Now let me tell you about our clever people. The machine has to go. And after the Monetary Control Act of 1980 was passed, and the judgment was made that your land values would fall in half, the lending institutions were no longer willing or able to supply the operating capital. So under the authority of the 1948 Farm Act, we created payment in kind. Payment in kind, or the certs as the farmers call them, are simply certificates of value created at the ASC office at the county level, and they are extinguished at the county level. The certs represent the difference between the loan value and the target price. They are a new money, so to speak. The farmer who elects not to go into the subsidy programs that the illiterate economists and the metro papers talk about will automatically take $1.17 in this mythical county difference. This means that every farmer who grows corn is forced into the program. He has no real choice. These bleeding hearts that haven't the slightest idea what they're talking about and harp about the subsidies should dig into it and find out what's going on under that gigantic trust created in 1913. And so the farmer has the corn in his bin, and he's got to provide the free labor to maintain its quality and to keep it there for 9 months. But maybe another crop's come along and he needs a space. So here's how it works. The ASC says, all right, pay us off in certificates, and we will let you pay it off at the market price and not at the loan price. And so the farmers accordingly bid up the certs to $1.15 or $1.18 because they can afford to do so to get that corn out of the bin and into the market. And the new money that was traded for fertilizer and whatever is now extinguished as it's returned to its founder where it was printed. So the farmer goes out and bids up the cert to $1.15 on a dollar because he's paying off at the market value, not at the loan value. And if you want to win an election, why, you see to it that the certificates are mailed out to these farmers in time, or they're promised in time. And what the mistake they made in this last election, they merely promised the corn farmer. They just promised him. They paid some out to the others. The promise wasn't good enough, and some valuable Senate seats were lost because of it. I could fill in the story for you on what happened as our international bankers, our 11 or 13 out of New York, roved the world and implanted money into Argentina to break the pampas, to introduce salt fertilizers and bring on new production. And then they went to them and said, starve your own people so the production can flow to the high market. And it flowed into the United States high market and undercut you. In one transaction alone, the Brazilians broke the soybean market $3 to $5, and their own people were starving. And yet, we have most of our American people all worshiping at the altar of surpluses. Of the five people running for Congress, drawn from our midst, who understand parity, all five of them went along with the stupidity of the Harkin bill. All of them have it in their head that they're going to manage the production because we have too much. They can't let go of it. And they all went down the tube. And it probably wouldn't have made a hell of a lot of difference. We have got to start understanding the name of the game. Farm prices are a political problem, and they will admit only to a political solution, because your international bankers say to Brazil and to Argentina, ship the meat north, and they undercut you, and their own starve. So I say, if we removed half the farmers off the land in the United States, instead of starving to death 55,000 people a day somewhere in the world, why, hell, we'll move it up to 100,000 a day. That's the way it's played. That's what it's all about, this cry about subsidies. What did they think would happen if we pursued the policies of the 1948 Farm Bill? Bill Moyer was on the phone, not on the phone, on the TV on election night. He and Dan Rather were pontificating, and they speak in a well-cultivated English voice, and they don't raise their voices, and they are so somber and so wise. And Bill Moyer said, They were talking about the farm problem and the matter of certain farmers putting a magnum in their mouth and taking leave. And Bill says, well, that's too bad, but it's got to go this way because the corporation form is so much more efficient. And Dan rather come in, well, now, wait a minute, Bill. You know, the 400-acre American farm is considered by many as one of the most efficient farms in the world. So they moved right off of it. Boy, they committed a faux pas there. And it wasn't brought up again. But isn't that an amazing statement from the press secretary of Lyndon Baines Johnson? Isn't that really amazing? In this conference, we are going to talk about an unidentified trend in America. We have a man here from Tuskegee University, our last speaker, I believe. He will agree with me. There's nothing I can do about American agriculture. There's nothing McMaster's can do about it, or any of us. It's a political problem. But we may be able to save a couple of 100,000 farms. There is an unidentified trend in America. People owning 10, 20, 30, 40 acres. They're not going to be able to make a living growing wheat or corn at international prices, but there are things they can do. And for this reason, we have Richard Miller on the program talking about herbs. Some 400 he's identified that could be produced here, all of which are imported. The black gentleman from Tuskegee will tell us how to, in certain instances, gross 100,000 off of 25 acres with a concerted program. We have to chase these things. We're not abandoning the corn, the wheat, the Milo farmer, the one who accounts for the storable commodities that are in this big political arena. Ladies and gentlemen, I've laid out in spades for you a few things they wouldn't say in St. Louis, because Harkin was busy taking off his coat and rolling up his sleeves in front of people. If he'd have run his socks between his toes, it couldn't have been any more cornpone. This crippled, subsidized agriculture is limping along, harnessed to a devastating technology that is polluting land, air, and water. They say, oh, Walters, you want to deny the poor, underdeveloped countries of the world access to our markets. You're an isolationist. No, I'm not an isolationist. I want this border open to the production of anybody in the world. It should be open. But not at 8 cents an hour labor. Not at 10 cents an hour labor. Harriet Woods was over there at St. Louis. And I said, Harriet, why don't any of you lay it out in spades? I'll tell you why she doesn't lay it out in spades. She don't know what spades are. I tried to explain to her the concept of equity of trade. The others in the room seemed to understand, but Harriet Woods did not understand. I said that everything should be allowed into the United States, but it should carry a parity that would bring it up to an American level. And I says, but, and this is the biggest but in history, that tariff does not belong to the United States Treasury. It belongs to the government or to the country of origin for that product. I wouldn't give them the cash, but I would hold here a credit for them to take any American production they want at an American price. Do you really think you're going to get the Egyptian off the mud floor when he's making a nickel an hour because you're allowing him to wreck your farmers or your people in the United States? I suggest that anybody that thinks that way better get themselves a guardian. No, we need to lay it out in spades instead of constructing a pyramid of debt that is going to devastate the civilized world. It's upset the economic pattern so wildly that they can't even be described. Even the Irish are importing potatoes. We need to lay it out in spades. Instead of constructing a pyramid of debt that is going to devastate the civilized world, it's upset the economic patterns so wildly that they can't even be described. Even the Irish are importing potatoes. I told you about surplus, sold so perfectly that nearly 100% of the farmers believe it. Now, what have we done? What have we done in these 35 years? We have killed incentive in the workplace. We've created rolling unemployment. You get your lesson. There's no way a man in business can lower the wage of a worker. It can't be done, believe me, and I've been in business a long time. If you want to bring your labor scale down, you have got to fire them. They have to be out on the market. And they have to discover that the only way they can get a job is to go to work for $4 and $5 an hour. Yes, we've killed incentive, and we've taxed people goofy to support this unreality, this Santa Claus image, where we're trying to manage the world from Washington by a bunch of people who can't manage their own families. Farmers have been forced into programs that can't work and won't work. The politicos try to manage production for a world that starves. One morning, not long ago, somebody called me about 6:37 in the morning on Sunday. I had written an article in the Kansas City Star, and he started cussing me right and left. I had quoted Bertolt Brecht. You know who Bertolt Brecht is? Few of you. He was the man who wrote Three Penny Opera. Now do you identify? All of you have heard of Three Penny Opera and some other plays. He was a German. He was a Jewish man. He joined the communists. My crime was I quoted the communist. I'm not sure I wouldn't have joined the communist when Hitler ordered me hung up with piano wire. And that's what happened to Bertolt Brecht. Hitler proscribed the play. And he was a hunted man until he got out of the country. He said, famines do not happen. Famines are created by the grain trade. They are created by Bunge and Born and Andre of Switzerland, Cargill and Continental and Dreyfus. They own a resource that goes beyond the dreams of avarice. They have title to every farmer in the world. And his production. And our USDA and the owner of the USDA, the U.S. State Department, makes good that title. And that's how the grain trade is managed. We're not serving our own people with that Congress, that rubber stamp operation that takes the nostrums of Brookings Institution and Council on Foreign Relations and whatever, and stamps them in the law without half of them knowing what they're signing or voting for. There was a bunch of them on the TV a long ago. They said, I voted for that tax bill. I had no idea what was in it. I believe it. The dang thing's that thick. I've read a good part of it and don't have an idea yet how it's going to affect me. Except it isn't going to be good. We are told that they are something like 47 million people in the United States that in full or in part are tax protesters. They're not playing along. They're in underground economy. Many do not even file. That should be a signal to any enlightened government to ease up a little. It isn't here. Taking the usual Hitler-esque approach, we've tightened the turnbuckle. I don't know who wrote that bill, but I'll make book that it wasn't anybody in Congress. Or any of the 100 millionaires in the U.S. Senate. It came from somebody, one of those institutions. They plunked it in on time, making the move because they thought they had to. They know now they've gone almost too far with agriculture, and so you have a chapter 12. Chapter 12 will allow certain farmers with certain grosses to wash out their debt. I've heard it reported 70%. The Department of Agriculture in Texas says, no, it's 50%. I do not know. I've not seen it all. When debt is not paid by the borrower, it's paid by the lender. And that debt is going to be given back to the lending agencies under the guidance of the referee in bankruptcy. And what does the bank do? Except the ones they want to go broke, they will roll back their reserve requirements from 7 to possibly 2. That's the schematic. This came off the wall in a matter of weeks and passed by Congress. Do any of you really believe that there is one man in Congress that knows enough economics to have dreamt that one up? Not the blubbermouths I've heard in their campaign speeches. I haven't heard a really intelligent speech out of any of the people running for Congress during this entire election. Harriet Woodson and Chris Bond included. Well, with all this, God remains in his heaven, and he smiles, perhaps. And the rhyme of the seasons prevails, and the seasons smile on the cycles and obey their rule. And the basic cops may get their reprieve. The cycles will likely intervene. Even the Andres and the Continentals and the Dreyfus and the Bungies and Bournes can't go against the grand cycles of the universe. My breakfast companion this morning said that he had read that the deficit was $3 million a day today, or international?
A billion, a week.
All right, I didn't have that statistic. This is the guy who told me that. I don't doubt it. I'm sure RE's got those data up a lot better than I have. I mentioned to you what our Kansas City Star guru said. It has cured inflation. It's lowered the interest rate. Just as the pundits promised, things would get better as soon as they got worse. That's what the man said. I'm still shaking my head over that column. Vince Rossiter was down here from Hartington, Harry, and he had read that column in the Omaha World Herald, and I think his head was still shaking. This is what we've got. This is what we've got advising us, our intellectual advisors. Well, I think I've probably taken more than my share of time. We will discuss this unidentified trend, small farms. And we will show to you that the young may make some use of this when this grand thing falls apart at the seam, because they have no alternative except to enter the labor market at that four and minimum wage and $5 an hour. There's a cottage industry out there awaiting them. There's a development of trucking and marketing and controller co-ops awaiting them. Ladies and gentlemen, there is a revisioning of the whys of farming in the wind. That's the beautiful thing I see. That's what we should set our antennas for. And this is what a good part of this conference will be about. Thank you. This is my remarks for the morning.